Okay, thanks, Mary. So what I've discovered is that if you're a chemist and want to give a colloquium in physics, you need to be invited by a mathematician. I'll be talking mostly, though, about physics or chemical physics today. Try to give you an overview of some of the questions relating to the optical properties of nanoscale systems, introduce what these are and why we might be interested in them, with an emphasis here on these words, design and control. So let me start by thanking the people who have done the work that I'll present with you, which is my students and postdocs who are here right now. On the left-hand side, as well as people who've worked my group in the past. And some of what I'll talk to you about relating to dissociating excitons and some questions about how to think about nanoscale excitons, a lot of these discussions came with Gary Rumbles at National Renewable Energy Lab. And that really inspired a lot of this thinking. So these nanoscale systems are much bigger, of course, than atoms or molecules, but much smaller than bulk semiconductors or metals. And they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. And I can classify the kinds of systems that we study here. So they would range from biological systems up on the top left here. These proteins are involved in light harvesting and photosynthesis, which I won't be talking about these today. But these turn out actually to be in some ways, the cleanest model systems for studying physical phenomena, which might surprise you. And then there's organic systems like carbon nanotubes, conjugated polymers, and inorganic systems like semiconductor quantum dots that I'll focus on today. And so in these last two kinds of systems, they're characterized by very delocalized wave functions, just like in the solid state. And that's what tends to make them interesting. So the kinds of questions that motivate what we do include understanding more details about dynamics, and this is not what I'll talk about today, but how does energy move through space, excitation energy after light is absorbed, and what is the importance of quantum aspects of those dynamics. But what I'll talk about today, I think, can be summarized with this very short question is, how can we control interactions between electrons? And I'll show you that this is a non-trivial question. Now, if you really understand how to do this, then you could do, you would know how to design organic systems, for example, where you could easily dissociate excitons into carriers, so that an organic system would be a natural photovoltaic device, which it's not. I'll say more about that. Now, as I said, I'll talk mostly about these nanocrystals, use these as examples. Now, they're crystals with many unit cells, typically thousands of unit cells in them, so you can think about them a lot like the bulk, except that they're smaller. And the particular nanocrystals or quantum dots that I'll talk about are colloidal, so they're in solution. Dissolved like a food dye or something in solution. So we can study them in solution, or you can make films. In these electron micrographs here, you see them forming these structures as you evaporate the solvent on the grid. Now, if you measure the optical absorption spectrum of this particular sample, you get the solid line there. And if we compare that to what you'd measure for the bulk, which is the dashed line, you see that they're very, very similar. So what you can learn from that is that the optical properties of these nanocrystals can be very, very much like the bulk, or the band structure, in other words, can be very similar to the bulk. This is europium sulfide. So it has rather a complicated band structure, and that's why it's a good test of this way of thinking. So you see there's some structure in here, and this comes because there's orbitals localized on the europium centers, and it's because of that actually that these have interesting magnetic properties. So this is a colloid that behaves a lot like bulk semiconductor. On the other hand, what you will have seen many, many times by now, I imagine, brightly colored solutions like this. So when we make these colloid dispersions and irradiate them with UV light and look at them, you see that the photoluminescence is tunable depending on how we make the colloid. So if we make the average size small, we'll see a blue shifted emission, a very blue shifted emission compared to the bulk. And then as we make the average size of these colloids bigger, you see the optical gap approaches that of the bulk. If you change the material that you're studying, then obviously you change where that optical gap is. So this is lead sulfide, which has a gap in the near infrared. So you have this tuning here depending on not just the size of the system, but also what it's made of. And I want to talk a little bit about, well, a lot actually, about what determines these optical properties and how you should think about it and what's interesting about these optical properties as far as I'm concerned. So the first thing is, in general, how do you think about these optical transitions? So if we plot density of states here on the y-axis versus energy, then unlike the europium sulfide, actually a typical one electron density of states for the bulk would look like this. If we confine that to make a quantum well, then in these idealized model here, the density of states has these steps in it. And a 1D system, like a carbon nanotube, has this kind of structure. And the 0D, which is our quantum dot, has these discrete levels. And these are just like orbitals in a molecule. You have to be careful in looking at these diagrams. So how to think about them in general is if we tip them on their side, like here for the carbon nanotube, these would look like the orbitals. And this is the band gap right here. But as you'll see, if you keep it in the back of your mind, this is a description really only of the frontier orbitals, or the lowest energy valence band and the highest energy valence band, lowest energy conduction band. So there's some simplifications here. You have to remember that this doesn't give you the whole picture, but it gives you a flavor of the problem. You go from continuous levels to discrete levels. But what I want to focus on here is that this picture here of the orbitals with the band gap indicated doesn't tell you anything about how electrons interact. So these are all one electron energies, and that's what defines the band gap. But if we measure the optical absorption spectrum of this carbon nanotube, we would see that the onset is at a much lower energy, actually about, for carbon nanotubes, about half that band gap. So there's a very significant amount of energy here that is to do with electron-electron interactions, and that's said to bind the exciton. And above that energy, so at the energy of the band gap, you have free carriers. Now, in bulk semiconductors, that binding energy is very small, just a few millielectron volts. And that's why if you photoexcite silicon crystal at room temperature, then you easily generate free carriers, which is the photovoltaic effect. You can see in these calculations from Sumit Mazumdar's group clearly what I mean by turning on electron-electron interactions, or that I didn't just make this up, is that here's a calculation. This is the energy of this transition here. So it's a calculation of all the electrons in a carbon nanotube of finite length without the electron-electron interactions turned on, in a sense, to describe the excited state. Now, when we turn them on, so we go beyond the Hartree-Fock level of description of the system, we find that the optical absorption has a resonance here, much lower energy, half an electron volt lower. And that defines the binding energy. And you can see it comes specifically from the electron-electron interactions, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in terms of generally how to think of nanoscale excitons and some implications, some examples with quantum dots. So just to give you some general background about these colloids, really have incredible control over not just keeping the size dispersions narrow here, which is obviously important since the properties are size dependent, but also their shape. You can see some examples here of synthesis changing the shape from a rod to a bullet to a pyramid type shape. And I'll show you some more tuning controls we have over synthesis as well. But how this works is that you need to learn how to make these crystals assume a non-equilibrium shape. Because what they want to be is spheres. The surface energy here is huge, and it dominates everything. So the ideal colloid would be spherical, so you minimize the surface energy. But the trick is, what I haven't shown you yet, is on the surface of these crystals are these things I've drawn as arrows. These are surfactant molecules, or ligands, which bind to the dangling bonds that would be at the surface of the crystal, so the bonds that want to continue into the bulk. And these are really important in how you make them, but they're also important in how you control the shape. So if I want to change the shape and make, say, this rod-shaped nanocrystal, what I'm doing here is increasing the surface area of specific crystal faces. As I grow it along this, say, this Wurtzite C-axis, I'm increasing these kinds of atoms on the surface. They're high energy. They don't want to be there. It should collapse into the sphere. What I want to do then is compensate for that. And in a sense, and I can do this by controlling surface tension, and you can understand this because you know that if you put a droplet of water on the surface of this bench here, it's going to be a spherical kind of shape. If I push on the edges, I can make it into a kind of cylindrical shape. And that's exactly what you do here. So we add some ligands, or these surfactants that bind even more strongly to those crystal faces, and that pushes on them, lowers their surface tension. And you can learn how to do this in even more complicated ways in chemistry. So I want to spend a few moments, though, coming back to the optical properties. And just think about a little bit, what is an exciton? And think about if our textbook pictures for excitons are enough to gain an understanding of how to control the photovoltaic effect in nanoscale systems. So here's the textbook picture of what an exciton is in the bulk. It's a good picture when you understand the limitations, and that is that when we take this electron from the valence band and put it in the conduction band, we're left with a hole in the valence band. Typically has a higher effective mass than the electron, and so we can picture this as the electron orbiting that hole, as described by your normal Hamiltonian for the hydrogen atom. We have the kinetic energy terms, and then this electron-hole attraction, and that gives you hydrogenic-like states. I think everybody here would know that the series goes up in energy, just like the orbitals of hydrogen atom. And this describes that in this case, we would say there's a ladder of these bound exciton states you would get in the bulk, which indeed you do. And just to generalize this for the nanoscale systems like quantum dots, we can add a confinement potential, the U term that describes the shape of the quantum dot. And all that really does, well, it shifts the energy of the levels, but what it does for practical purposes is it removes momentum as a valid quantum number, and so gives us a ladder of states more like how we draw from molecule. It doesn't change the problem that much. Now, I can reproduce this in a little bit more detail by considering specifically the atomic structure or the arrangement of unit cells in the nanoscale system. So I could draw, say, my block functions located at every primitive cell in the crystal if I wanted to, and say that these are my building blocks. I can choose any basis I want to. It doesn't really matter. The point is that if I have this basis, I've just drawn them in a line here for a model 1D system. When I absorb a photon in this basis that I'm going to start with, there's two things I could do. I could take an electron and I could transfer it from this localized block function in the valence band to a localized block function in the conduction band on that site, or I could move it to a different site. So there's two options here that I have. So if I consider all of them and I can write them down in this Hamiltonian, so I have a block that's where I'm putting the excitations on the site and a block where I'm moving it, and I just end up with this diagonal Hamiltonian, so it's already diagonalized, and I get this ladder of states, the lowest one here, the next one here, the next one here, and they converge to a continuum of states. And this is exactly the same picture that I showed you before. So optical excitation could excite this lowest exciton state. In this picture here, we wouldn't ionize the system or generate carriers until we get right to the top of this ladder. This is, if you want to know where this formalism comes from, it's a valence bond representation of the system. And it's including electron-electron interactions. What this is a lot like, and where this ladder actually comes from, is the fact that it costs energy to separate electron and a hole, because they attract each other. Now, you can see this from the orbitals of a molecule like benzene, where the highest energy valence and lowest energy conduction orbitals, so this is one of those conduction orbitals, or molecular orbitals in this case, which looks like this if we plot the density. But we have this other series of orbitals called Rydberg orbitals, and here you take the electron away from the atomic centers, and you can see them in spectroscopy of these molecules, and this is what the density of them look like. So they get increasingly further from the atomic centers, Rydberg transition, and we know it costs a lot of energy to move an electron into these orbitals, much more than an electron volt. So there's a big penalty you have to pay for separating the electron and the hole. So then you would ask, well, what's so special about excitons? Doesn't seem like they have any advantage over a molecule in terms of how easy it is to ionize them, which is, remember, the photovoltaic effect. What energy does it take above the lowest energy to separate the electron and the hole? So they're free carriers. Well, that's because there's something missing from this model that's special about excitons that makes them interesting, and that is that this ladder of states here is a good basis to start from, but importantly, in excitonic systems, because they refer to this spatial separation of electron and a hole, there's an off-diagonal part of the Hamiltonian which we need to put in. That's the transfer integral, the Hopping integral. So this is what gives you conduction. And these are very strong for semiconductors because these systems are bonded, and this is what gives you chemical bonding in that case. So we need to add these off diagonals, and that mixes these states. And this is crucial because what this means, so these are different values of that Hopping integral. So the easier it is to hop or mix those configurations, you see the smaller the binding energy gets of the exciton. So at this point, at the red bar here, we have free carriers. And why that is that the value of the Hopping integral is bigger than the spacing between these states. And so you can actually access this ionization level without having to go all the way up in that energy, because we've made these eigenstates that mix this bunch of states here, and so they all contain this sort of ionization characteristic, or that the electron and the hole are free to hop. So it's easier to hop than to be bound. So this is an important picture I can summarize here. And that is how to think about these nanoscale excitons so that we can understand the relationship between bound excitons and free carriers. So you end up, this is density of states now, plotted versus energy, you end up with this manifold of the bound exciton states. If I have 1,000, just 1,000 unit cells here, I have 1,000 of those states. But I'll have 1,000,000 free carrier states, or these charge transfer excitons, however you want to label them. So there's a huge density of these states up here, the carriers. So if this were my excitonic system, my perfect system, well, the optical absorption strength is typically down here. What I would imagine, though, if I excite down here, and this gap is about half an electron volt, which it is for carbon nanotubes, I wouldn't generate carriers. But as I increase my excitation energy and start being able to excite into these charge transfer states or carriers, then I would start to see carrier formation in a small yield. And that's actually is what you see. But here's the problem with the organic semiconductors, that this binding energy, the difference between this, the lowest part of this carrier density of states and my bound states is big. This typically is half an electron volt. And that's determined, as I said, by electron-electron interactions. This is the binding energy. So if you wanted to make an excitonic, an organic excitonic system that shows the photovoltaic effect, you have to work out how to reduce this energy. And there's a number of factors that come into this, which I'll talk a little bit more about. One way of doing it is to make a heterostructure. So, and I'll show you an example of heterostructures in terms of these quantum dots. And the concept is there's two ways we could do this. We could make our core excitonic system with valence band, conduction band, and a shell where the band offsets are like this, and that protects the surface of the quantum dot. So all this does is give you a really brightly luminescent dot. And this is really important for commercial applications right now with these materials. On the other hand, if I stagger the band offsets, so the top of the valence, bottom of the conduction band of these two materials, and interface them, and this is well known in solid state. For example, we could have this cadmium selenide rod and we could coat it with cadmium telluride. Now I have a different situation. If I photo-excite the cadmium telluride, then naturally an electron will cross the interface and we naturally have charge separation. So we're overcoming this binding energy just by offsetting the bands. And this is very effective. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But how to think about this really in the excitonic picture is it's more interesting, I think, than those band offsets. And that is we've overcome this paradigm that we had with the excitons where we have this bound density of states and the carriers in that order. By making that excitonic heterostructure, this is the same kind of calculations I showed you before, what you managed to do, here's the bright states right here. Here's where we would see, I'm going to show you in a moment, charge transfer emission. And below that, we have a big density of states of charge carriers. So now they're lower than where the optical absorption takes place, just how we want them. So optical absorption now does lead to carrier formation, although you lose a bit of energy in the relaxation process. So this this is an important picture, I think, of how to think about these systems. I'll show you an example briefly to think a little bit more about the problem, and that is the picture I showed you before. So this is a cartoon, but we would grow this nanocrystal cadmium selenide and then grow onto the end of it cadmium telluride. And this will make the heterojunction, so we have a type 2 band offset between the two materials. So again, here's my cartoon of what the system looks like. But now with the band offsets, because these are now confined excitons, the levels are changed by the size. So we don't know exactly what the band offsets are. We can change them, though, by changing the size of the materials. So I could represent that like this. And here's a picture of the absorption spectrum of the cadmium telluride part. And then when we add the cadmium selenide part, when we add the cadmium telluride, we add its absorption feature. And then as we grow that part of the rod bigger, you can see we can redshift that absorption. So that's the quantum size effect. But just on one half of the rod, you see in the growth. So we can tune the size of our particle in a box on each side of the rod here. And, of course, it's easy. When I show you this, it's not trivial to do the synthetic chemistry to make this happen, I might add. Now, here's the spectroscopy of the system on an energy scale now, instead of this wavelength scale. Here's the absorption spectrum of one particular sample. And there's two notable features here on the edge. One is this absorption, which is cadmium telluride, just on one end of the rod, and the other red-shifted broad absorption is charge transfer absorption. And we see the mirror image in the photoluminescence. So we see excitonic emission from cadmium telluride and this new feature that isn't present in either half of the rod, which is radiative recombination across the interface of these two nanocrystals. And I refer to that as the charge transfer emission. And if you remember the calculations I had before, what we'd imagine is that there's also a big density of states down here, which are dark, which are the really widely separated electrons and holes. Now, the one point I just want to discuss briefly here about these systems, what we can learn from them, is if we want to think about how the charge is transferred after we photoexcite the cadmium telluride. Is it instantaneous? Does it take a long time? How do we know? So this picture of the band offsets tells us it should happen, but this is a zero Kelvin picture of what goes on. Now, if we can convert this to a room temperature picture, then this is a good starting point for thinking about the dynamics, as I'll show you. So to do this, we need to think about, and this is just for these levels that we can see in spectroscopy, not every exciton state, I might add. So we want to think about then how the reaction happens, how these charge transfer reactions happen is that you have to move something, electrons or nuclei, to accommodate this change in charge distribution. So after we photoexcite the cadmium telluride, will be at that point there of a free energy curve in space, where that reaction coordinate is these trillions of nuclear and electronic degrees of freedom around and including the nanocrystal. So this is thermodynamics, and this is an ensemble picture. So overall, we would say that we know that the charge transfer state is lower energy, but it's only lower energy once everything reorganizes, all these nuclear degrees of freedom to accommodate that change in charge distribution. And these are not potential energy curves. Okay, so if I put my ball up on here, it doesn't roll down to the lowest energy here. This is not how to interpret these curves. And it's actually very interesting to think about them some more, which I won't go into, except to say how to think about it. You have to imagine one process at a time. The nuclear degrees of freedom are fluctuating and the energy of the state you're in is randomly hopping around, and at some point it might reach the configuration where the lowest energy state is this charge-separated state, and then you can relax into it. It's stochastic fluctuations. Now, what you can also predict, what Marcus predicted from these free energy curves, is that this is a normal activated process. We have to go over a barrier, ultimately, this ensemble picture. And from this picture, you can work out a rate expression, this activated barrier crossing. And if I make my final state more favorable, so the driving force is bigger, if I drop it down in energy, I can lower the barrier that I would need to jump over to get to the product. On the other hand, if I'm in a situation where my nuclear degrees of freedom don't need to change very much at all to accommodate this change in charge distribution, then my reactant curve isn't so displaced on the reaction coordinate. And now what you see is that I'm crossing actually on the left-hand side over here. And what this is, to do this, this is no longer a classical process. You need a tunneling process to cross the barrier now. So it's a fundamentally different kind of process. So now the bigger the driving force, the more favorable my reaction, the bigger that barrier gets, and the less likely it is to happen. It's called the inverted region. So these are two limits, the dynamics. And it would be interesting to understand what limit these heterostructures are in. And you can actually determine this from spectroscopy. So because I have the absorption and emission into each of these two levels, so from the ground state, or from once I'm in the excited state, I can fit them to an equation under certain approximations and obtain at least a reasonable picture of these free energy curves from experiment for each individual sample we're looking at. And the fitting here involves the homogeneous width of these transitions, but that width parameter is double-checked, if you like, by the Stokes shift, the energy shift between the absorption and emission. And that's because of the fluctuation dissipation theorem. They have to give the same result. So there's internal checks that we're not just making this up. And so this is what you get from analyzing that particular experimental situation. And so here's my reactant, cadmium telluride excited state. There's the product, the charge separated state. And this is the characteristic result, is that these samples were always in the inverted region. And that's because, as you'd expect, actually, the reorganization energy is small. So these nanocrystals are weakly coupled to the environment. And that's good that we can see that that is indeed true in these nanocrystalline systems, like you'd hope it would be true. So that means you would have very narrow absorption line width, say, at low temperature for one individual nanocrystal. But this is interesting result because when you have a small molecule, to describe dynamics involving that, so something with just a few atoms, you're typically weakly coupled to the environment, especially if you're studying this in the gas phase, of course. There's very few nuclear degrees of freedom, and you really do draw potential energy curves to decide how reactions happen involving small molecules. On the other hand, what makes condensed phase spectroscopy of big molecules difficult is that what dominates everything is you're very strongly coupled to the environment. And that's why the absorption spectrum, optical spectroscopy of these systems just gives a big blob, essentially, in the absorption spectra. Now, when we've made our solute even bigger, this nanoscale, it's now turning out that we're returning to this case where we're weakly coupled to the environment, which can be desirable if we want to see quantum effects, of course. Now, the last little picture about this system is that you can indeed change the size, the two halves of the rod, and you can tune yourself through different free energy curves. So we can explore different regimes of Marcus theory. As of yet, it's pretty hard with this small reorganization energy to get into the activated regime. But we can get close to a situation where we're almost barrierless. So this is another particular sample we studied with the spectroscopy here. What happens here is because the reactant and product curves are now so close together, is that this diabatic picture is incorrect, and these curves mix, and you have these new adiabatic curves. Again, this is made possible because of the small coupling to nuclear motion. So instead of these crossing diabatic curves, we have to diagonalize our Hamiltonian, and actually what you see in spectroscopy are these adiabatic surfaces here. And you can actually see that in the absorption spectrum. Now, what used to be the charge transfer band has exactly the same oscillator strength as what used to be the cadmium telluride band, and that's because they're mixed states of each. And the final 10-second word on these systems is that while they are weakly coupled to the environment, this charge transfer state does interact with solvent polarizability, and you can measure this effect in these photoemission spectra. So you do see everything I showed you was in toluene, which is low dielectric environment. Here is the energy of the emission band for this sample. If we increase the dielectric environment of our around the nanocrystal, so of the solvent, we can redshift that band. So you can start to see how these systems are coupled to the environment. Okay, I already said that bit there. So now I'm going to return very briefly to this, to other ways of beating this bound exciton paradigm, and that is without making heterojunctions. This is unsolved problem. But the idea is, again, you want to be able to control exciton-exciton interactions to decrease that binding energy. Can you do that? Is the question. If you want to do that, what you have to do is control how electrons interact. And you can do that with structure. At the moment, there aren't design guidelines. But the big point here is that this is not just a matter of thinking about how charge distributions interact. Okay, the problem is more interesting because how the charge distributions interact depend on the spin pairing of electrons. And you know that, of course, that electrons with the same spin naturally avoid each other, so the repulsions are lowered. So you can play interesting games potentially here with chemical structure to decrease that binding energy if one were interested. You can do... You can think about exciton shape, and I'm going to finish up by telling you a little bit about exciton shape and see if the shape actually controls how electrons interact. This would be much more subtle. Obviously, in these systems, these are some of the colloids made in my group that contain thousands of atoms compared to molecules like this that contain tens of atoms. And I'll tell you a little bit about thinking about, well, can we change the wave function, and if so, why? So I showed you an example of that already, of moving the electron away from the hole. And I'll show you an example where there could be important implications for that. So what I'm going to show you in the last 10 minutes here then is something about getting in a bit more detail about excitons. So because these bound excitons are a lot like electronic cytostates of molecule, they become more complicated. We can't just have this picture of non-interacting electrons and holes. So we have these spin states. In a molecule, you have singlet and three triplets. Here, it's a little more complicated because you have spin orbit coupling and because you have a more complicated valence band. And so for the cadmium, let's just look at this picture here. For the cadmium selenide quantum dots, we actually have 8 of these so-called fine structure states. These define the exciton. You do not have these for carriers if this is a band-to-band transition. The trick is that these are separated only by tens of millielectron volts, and they're hidden, so underneath our inhomogeneously broadened line. So they're very hard to study. And I'll show you how one can study them and what we can learn by using the selection rules for exciting these states. So for these states with angular momentum plus or minus 1, total angular momentum that is, just like this is well known in solid state, is that these are photo-excited with selection rules for left and right circularly polarized light. It would be oriented along the crystallographic axis there. And I'm going to really briefly describe how to think or how this experiment works, but I'm not going to go into a description of the itty-bitty details of it. But I'll give you a picture of how to think about it, because what we're measuring here, what enables us to see these dynamics in the fine structure, I'm going to tell you how the exciton moves through the fine structure. It's not something that is a usual technique in ultrafast spectroscopy. So usually what happens in ultrafast spectroscopy, if you want to measure the dynamics of something, you would have a pump pulse, so one pulse here, and a probe pulse delayed after that. And the pump pulse makes excitons. It's this experiment here. And the probe pulse comes after, and it just asks if the exciton is still there, if you've recombined to the ground state. And that's what we're seeing here. These fast dynamics are because some of the excitons get their hole trapped on the surface. And it quenches the excited state, removes it from our view. The experiment that I'm going to show you removes all of that stuff. And it directly measures only transitions where the total angular momentum, the exciton changes sign. So say from plus 1 to minus 1, plus 1 to minus 2, even though the minus 2 is dark. And it does this through a clever kind of interference effect in this nonlinear spectroscopy. So it's the same as pump probe, except the pump pulse comes as two light-matter interactions each differently polarized. And that generates the excitons, but what it's doing, it's tagging them in a way. So even though we're exciting equal amounts of plus and minus angular momentum excitons, plus and minus one in this case, we can actually see if a plus one turns to a minus one. And we see that through this interference. So after the probe, the signal is radiated. It would look like this, the electric field of this signal. Now, and that's exactly what the signal will look like if the angular momentum hasn't changed during this population time. But if the plus one turns to a minus one exciton with different total angular momentum, that radiated polarization, it's still radiated because there's lots of excitons, but it's phase shifted by pi. And then when these guys, when we sum up all of these signals from the ensemble, once we've reached equilibrium, we have equal amounts of unflipped and flipped total angular momenta, we'll sum all of these electric fields on the detector and it'll look like there's no signal. So instead of seeing this, we see this. So this is a direct measure of how long it takes to flip these total angular momenta, and you can do the experiment with a different polarization sequence and you get a sort of mirror image that complements this a little bit. So what I just want to tell you about today, about this experiment, is that we're really interested, because this sees the fine structure, and the fine structure depends on shape, if we can measure these dynamics of the relaxation in the fine structure, can we see if shape matters? Does shape affect these dynamics? So what we found is that, interestingly, the dynamics, the fastest dynamics here, so here's again the data, a typical data set like I showed you before, and here's some of these curves for different size nanorods. If we extract the fastest rate of this change in angular momentum, it follows this extraordinary 1 on radius to the power of 4 dependence, and it doesn't matter whether we're looking at dots or rods, it's always the radius, not the length of the rod. So these little pink boxes tell you the shape of the rods corresponding to their data points here. So why do you get this over this huge range of sizes actually and shapes? Why do you get this dependence? To understand this, you need to look briefly at the Hamiltonian for the exciton. So I've divided into this so-called standard form, where I have my electron spin up on this block, electron spin down on this block, and I've diagonalized it so that the spin-orbit coupling is included here. So these are my total angular momenta states, the fine structure, which will give the fine structure states here after I mix them with the exchange interaction. The point is, what we need is something in these off-diagonal blocks that's not shown that would give us a perturbation that would change the total angular momentum of the exciton and allow a mixing, say, from plus 1 to minus 2 or plus 1 to minus 1. So first idea is that these nanocrystals, this is not at zero Kelvin, this is at room temperature, actually, and the atoms are moving. And so they move in a particular prescribed way according to exactly how the Earth moves inside its core. So the geophysicist will probably recognize this equation, which is the quantized modes of an elastic sphere, and that does describe these acoustic phonons in the nanocrystal. So instead of sound waves in the bulk, we have these quantized acoustic phonons. And so as you move the atoms here, you lower the symmetry of each unit cell, and that allows a mixing. But this particular mixing, if we add these matrix elements, it's small for a start. These are the matrix elements, these strain terms. They would actually turn on mixing between plus 1 and 0, minus 1 and 0, and so on. So they would introduce a specific pathway of relaxation. And from other experiments, I can show that this is not determining the size dependence, but B, analyzing the data from this kinetic scheme is inconsistent with that pathway. So, I mean, when you look at this scheme, you would imagine that you just fall down a ladder of states, just going down and down in energy. That's not true. you follow a specific pathway according to what interactions are allowed, allow you to mix these states. So let me pass through that slide on the acoustic phonons and come to what actually does give the size dependence, which I can show you in the final 2 minutes here. And that is, when we think about the spin-orbit coupling, when we turn that on, as I said, the main contribution is in the diagonal, but there's a term that's not included here, which is the Dresselhaus term, which is a small perturbation. And what this does in the bulk is it allows you to mix with a higher energy, or depending on the valence band, a lower energy K state. And through that mixing, you can mix plus one and minus one, or minus one and plus two states in the valence band. But K is not a quantum number in this case. So to understand and work out this 1 on r to the 4 rate dependence, what you have to do is change K to minus IH bar del, which was developed by workers a decade or so ago to make this substitution. And once we put it in here, this gradient operator operates only on the envelope function of the exciton. And so we have we partition the equation into the two halves. One is the Hamiltonian, operates on the block function, and that determines the mechanism, but it has no information on size. It's this gradient operator operates only on the envelope function, the shape of the nanocrystal, that determines the size dependence. And if you work this out, probably people here could do it analytically. These envelopes are a product of spherical harmonics and spherical Bessel functions, but I had to use Mathematica. But you get this, the matrix element, you get a 1 on r squared. Therefore, the rate, according to Fermi-Golden rule, would be 1 on r to the 4. So there's good evidence that this Dresselhaus term is what's flipping the total angular momentum. It also explains, because this is a mixing, you turn on the bright-dark mixing, why when you go to 1 Kelvin and measure the radiative lifetime of those dark triplet states, the plus and minus one plus and minus two excitons, they actually have quite a fast radiative lifetime. So they recombine in about a microsecond, which for a dark state is fast. And that's because you have this mixing here, I believe, with the bright states. So I send that. The last slide I'll show you is just coming back to the concept of control. So according to this mechanism, what's deciding on how fast you change the total angular momentum of the exciton, or what the spins in the valence and conduction band are doing, is the valence band. So if we want to orient our electron spin and keep it oriented, we have to get rid of the hole. And what I'll put to you is that this could be done by designing the right heterostructure such that when we in this case, we would have to photo-excite. This would be the lowest energy excitation. And after we photo-excite it, we would need to get rid of the hole. And then the electron will be left isolated from the hole. And one would conjecture that this would slow its relaxation. And that's an example of how you can control these wave functions with the heterostructure. So I'll finish on that point. Thanks very much. That is because, so these terms in the Hamiltonian, so at room temperature with the thermal background. So how you think of this is that if you watch one nanocrystal as a function of time, and you're coupling to this acoustic phonon Hamiltonian, and the atoms are moving, and if you follow them in time in that nanocrystal, the Hamiltonian is going to track these distortions, these strains, and those the eigenstates, those fine structure states, are going to be not just moving, fluctuating up and down in energy on time from the diagonal contributions from these the strain effects, but the mixing between them will change with time. So you're going to be juggling that picture that I have, that I keep showing here of the of these eigenstates here, the exciton fine structure. The spacing between those levels and the absolute position will be jiggling around with time stochastically. Yeah, that's right, and that's what allows you to relax through the fine structure states at room temperature. So, if we start in this state here, which is we do start up here, we can fall down the ladder according to the mechanisms that allow us to step through the rungs. But the energy conservation is ensured because you're coupling to these motions of the environment. You can transfer phonons in and out of the nanocrystal. So you have to have that random motion to do that. Yeah. In here? Or in forward? Well, you're very weakly coupled to the solvent polarization here. So what that does is that would shift the levels up or down, okay, typically down. Would stabilize them relative to the ground state, in this case, according to the change in dipole or electron density after you photoexcite. But this is negligibly small, we know from experiment in these systems. Another way, an alternative way of, so a more physics way of thinking about the dielectric of the environment is that it's the change in dielectric from high dielectric blob here, which is the nanocrystal, to low dielectric solvent, which defines the confinement potential. So this is a different viewpoint on that. Not decoherence, but population relaxation. Yeah. So, which? You can in the heterostructures. In the quantum dot, I'm not sure how much separation you'd get. You probably will end up just putting the holes on the surface state, and then you won't have the excitons. But in the heterostructures, there's evidence you absolutely can control this. You can actually hold the electron in the hole apart with an electric field for many milliseconds, and you release the field, and then they recombine. Right, exactly. So you can make nanoparticles out of small organic molecules or out of conjugated polymers. What happens, so these kinds of nanoscale systems, what you have is you have a weaker interaction between the subunits. So my subunits in the inorganic system or the carbon nanotube are primitive cells, and they're strongly coupled with these transfer integrals. When we have the molecules, even though they can be close together, they're still only about 3 angstrom close to each other. And because the wave functions tail off exponentially, that you have very small transfer integrals in this case. But in principle, you for something like pentacene, where they come together with pretty good pi-pi overlap, you are making an excitonic system, which has the features that I showed you with the bound excitons and the charge carriers. Now, you want to know how you would see this. I think this, to see that picture that I showed you, this is really hard, because all those charge transfer excitons, there's millions of states that, you know, I'm focused on here. Well, I'm focused on excitons because we can see them optically. The charge transfer or the carrier states are dark. You can't see them. You can see them in modulation experiments where you turn a field on and off, shift the absorption spectrum. And in some new experiments we're setting up, we're looking to see them indirectly using a 2D electronic technique where we're correlating the excitonic states that are optically active with transitions to two exciton states, which can occur from a dark state initially. And so these are indirect ways. Yeah, so all those states that are really interesting, this is a real challenge to identify them and to track them.